tonight on Arena. Liberation, Gavin Ringan on Daniel O'Connell and the music of the 19th century, and a look back at the best of this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Daniel O'Connell, known to all Irish people as the Liberator, secured Catholic emancipation in 1829, which allowed him to be elected to the Westminster Parliament. He was an avowed advocate of liberal and reform causes, a slavery abolitionist and a champion of the poor. He was also a contemporary of some of the greatest composers of all time, many of whom were equally passionate about political causes, including, amongst others, Beethoven, a committed Republican. Celebrating this confluence of music and socio-political movements, Irish tenor Gavin Ring has put together a gala concert in conjunction with the Daniel O'Connell Summer School. The concert, appropriately enough, is called Liberation, and it takes place this Saturday, October the 23rd, including music by Clara Schumann, Beethoven, of course, John Field, and the great Irish bard Thomas Moore. Delighted to have Gavin Ring join me now on the line from London. Where did the idea of putting O'Connell and the great musicians of this era together, where did that come from, Gavin? Great idea.
Good evening, Sean, and thanks very much for having me on the programme. Well, I was approached by the Daniel O'Connell Summer School to curate something like this for this year's Summer School. So I got thinking about O'Connell and looking at his lifetime. It wouldn't take a rocket scientist to realise that he was alive at possibly the greatest period of classical music and operatic composition. And I suppose concurrently because of O'Connell's socio-political and European locus conceptually, both he and the composers in question were, certainly as far as I'm concerned anyway, they were all part of this spectrum or zeitgeist of liberation, hence the title of the concert, as it were. So the programme is very much themed around that idea or that zeitgeist of revolution, be it someone like, you know, Mozart, who himself was inspired by the Enlightenment movement, or championing someone like Clara Schumann from the male-dominated compositional canon, or indeed a more visceral contemporary link with a composer like Beethoven, who was unquestionably political in his outlook and motivations.
For sure, and Beethoven definitely plays a big part in how you've programmed this concert. Did you have to dig very deep to find the matching philosophies between Beethoven then and O'Connell, Gavin?
No, not very deep at all. Beethoven was intensely political. And, you know, I guess both Beethoven and O'Connell, they were both cultural contemporaries, absolute cultural contemporaries in a way. And, you know, because they were both Catholic. They were born only 5 years apart from each other. Beethoven was born in 1770, O'Connell in 1775. And they both came of age in a rapidly changing and fluctuating Europe. And the trajectory of their respective lives is heavily influenced by this. They both very much shared an allegiance to many of the ideas of the French Revolution, those ideas of liberty, equality and fraternity. And O'Connell himself had strong connections to the United Irishmen, of course, although he did condemn Robert Emmet's 1803 uprising in Dublin. But, of course, many of your listeners will know of O'Connell's disavowal of achieving Irish freedom by means of force. And I suppose he was somewhat of a champion in that regard and became internationally respected throughout the generations. I mean, somebody like Mahatma Gandhi, people like Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King would have looked to O'Connell as an inspiration in terms of that championing pacifism in terms of a mass political movement. But anyway, back to bring it back contextually, as it were.
Bring me back to Beethoven, and specifically bring me to Fidelio, his one and only opera. To what extent do we get these kind of liberation ideals within this opera, which incidentally you're working on at the moment? But let's come back to that in a second. Let's talk about the connection between Beethoven and O'Connell first, and this opera, Fidelio.
Well, one of the principal themes of Fidelio is that of political prisonership. And Fidelio was written at a time when Vienna was occupied by the French forces, as it were, or certainly it was premiered during that time, the Fidelio we know today. And so that core, as it were, that idea of political strife, of there being some form of liberation from at the end, is central to the idea of Fidelio. are central to the story of Fidelio. And, you know, Beethoven was hugely politically motivated. He was somebody who was really taken by the ideas of the French Revolution. He was absolutely smitten by the champion of that revolution, certainly before he crowned himself emperor, of course, Napoleon.
Yeah.
He dedicated his Third Symphony to Napoleon. He actually called it originally the Bonaparte Symphony. But because Napoleon yeah. crowned himself emperor in 1804, Beethoven saw this as an out-and-out betrayal of all this. And in fact, the story goes is that in a fit of temper, he got his score of the Bonaparte Symphony, as it was then, and he scratched Napoleon's name out of it, and he exclaimed, "Ah, he's a rascal just like all the others."
Yeah, he wasn't afraid to say what he was thinking, for sure.
Certainly not.
We're going to listen to a recording of a little piece from Fidelio, from the Beethoven opera, and as you say, imprisonment very much at the heart of this. The singer here is Jonas Kaufmann with the Lucerne Festival Orchestra, but as I say, you're going to be singing from Fidelio at the concert, Gavin, and also you're involved in it in Glyndebourne. But let's listen to Jonas Kaufmann first of all. Beautiful music here. Section there of music from Beethoven's opera Fidelio. Jonas Kaufmann, the singer there with the Lucerne Festival Orchestra. Gavin Ring speaking to me this evening about music from that opera that he will be using as part of his concert Liberation, the music of Daniel O'Connell, taking place as part of the Daniel O'Connell Summer School this weekend. The opera itself, you mentioned, Gavin, direct references to imprisonment that are involved in the plot of the opera. Tell me about what you're doing with the opera in Glasgow.
Well, I'm very, very grateful at the moment, actually. I'm back at it, Sean, down here in the south of England, and we've put up the show. It's been up now since the 7th of October, and we've been performing it now, and it's a tremendous piece. It really is. I mean, the music is, it's spellbinding, and Beethoven is one of those composers as a singer that you don't deal with all that often. I mean, you do some maybe of his art song and things like that, but operatically speaking, because there's only one, you don't get a chance, let's say, on the same level that, let's say, an instrumentalist would to work on Beethoven on a regular basis.
I was going to say that to you, you know, when we think of Beethoven, we think of piano music, we think of the big symphonies, we think of orchestral music, but there he, and string quartets, but there for sure he shows us he knew how to write a melody and he knew how to write it for the voice, for sure. And you're a leading tenor at this year's Glyndebourne Opera Festival. That's quite a break to get in the career, I would have thought.
Absolutely. Look, I'm absolutely thrilled to be down at such a prestigious company, a prestigious opera house, performing with a stellar cast. And it's just fantastic to be back on stage in front of full houses, in front, you know, with the orchestra below you rising up. It's, you know, so many of the things before the pandemic you sort of took for granted slightly. And
anymore.
I tell you, never, never again.
Speaking of venues and performing in front of people, I'm wondering what Daniel O'Connell would make of your venue for performance on Saturday evening, the Skellig 618 Distillery in Cahir Sibhín. He'd like the Cahir Sibhín and the County Kerry part of it for sure. What about the distillery part?
Oh, I think he'd have enjoyed that, Sean, big time. You know, O'Connell was somebody who enjoyed an opulent lifestyle, and he was actually famed for always having a fair amount of debt as a result of this. But such was the truth of it, I suppose, is that he had a taste for the finer things in life. So if O'Connell had one drop of the fantastic Skellig 618 gin and soon-to-be-released whiskey, he would absolutely approve.
I'm sure he would. Let us move on to another composer. And when we think of John Field, we may think of the beautiful quality of his nocturnes. But when John Field started on the nocturnes, that was a revolutionary act in itself, musically at any rate.
without shadow of a doubt, Sean. I mean, John Field is an exemplary, and he's a radical figure as far as the delineation of piano music in the early 19th century is concerned. You know, he played for Beethoven at one point, and Beethoven was supremely impressed by his prowess. But yes, he revolutionized the nocturne in the early 19th century, and that had a profound impact then on composers, especially the likes of Chopin, Brahms and Robert Schumann. So without John Field, it's possible we wouldn't have had those great compositions of those composers either. But again, all feeding into this zeitgeist of the time, revolution or something radical, be it socially or culturally, this is very much the paradigm of O'Connell's era, you know?
Yeah, and of course, while you will be there yourself, you won't be there alone. You'll have others with you to provide the music. Fiacha Garvey will be on piano on Saturday night, and let's have a listen to what he'll be. Will he be playing the Field Nocturne, the number 5 in B flat? Is he playing that specific one on the night? Is that the plan?
That's the plan.
Well, listen to this. This is a pianist called Elizabeth Joy Rowe, and it's such a beautiful piece of music. Great to hear it at any time in any place. Field's Nocturne number 5 in B flat major, Elizabeth Joy Rowe, the pianist in that recording. But Gavin Ring speaking with me this evening about a concert he's performing in this weekend, Liberation, the music of Daniel O'Connell. And I did have to look twice when I saw the title of this. I thought, Daniel O'Connell now, did he do make music that I knew nothing about and haven't heard of up to this point? But that idea of linking what revolutionary ideas were being thrown around in the music world with Daniel O'Connell. When you went looking at it in any depth at all, Gavin, you must have been very excited.
Incredibly excited. And it's funny you say that, actually. Somebody said to me there recently, oh, I heard you were doing a concert, the music of Daniel O'Donnell. And I thought that was a bit of a departure for you, Gavin. But no, in all fairness, it's incredibly exciting because, like I said at the start of the interview, this period, in which was contemporaneous with O'Connell, musically speaking, was possibly one of the most exciting as far as developments were concerned in music, because I guess for a great degree, certainly the 50 years of the 18th century, music, I suppose, although very beautiful and incredibly expressive, was quite formal and structured, and it was kind of like I term it the 1950s of classical music, because it was kind of picket fenced, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
and everything had its place. And then you had people like Beethoven, and people like Clara Schumann, and people like John Field, and all these sort of influence, of course, heavily by the cultural spirit of enlightenment and change and revolution, applying that conceptuality. To their art. It's terribly exciting. And the whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, because music is a cultural phenomenon, and that's how we must look at it. So O'Connell and music, that entire time is all linked together in one fantastic effervescence.
However, unfortunately, revolution didn't make its way into the place of women, certainly in the music world and in lots of the arts. They really were sidestepped and pushed to the one side. And that was the case with Clara Schumann. Is that one of your big reasons for including her music in this concert?
Absolutely. And, you know, O'Connell was the great emancipator, as it were. And I think that, I suppose, over the last 15 to 20 years, we've had an emancipation of sorts for somebody like Clara Schumann. I suppose to keep within that idea of liberation or emancipation, we felt that including music by Clara Schumann was incredibly important. You know, as I say, her exoneration is totally justified, because her contribution to the canon is just as important and as influential in terms of the delineation of early 19th century composition as that of her male counterparts, as it were.
And it's Nicola Wing who will be singing the Clara Schumann songs, or the pieces, one of the pieces from Clara Schumann.
My good wife, yes, yes. Nicola Wing, she'll be there. My other significantly better half.
I thought there might be a connection, okay, when I saw Nicola Ring and Gavin Ring. I kind of thought, I wonder, is there a connection there? So the song that Nicola will be singing, Liebst du Schönheit, can you give us
this is one of three, yes, one of three Lieder or three songs by Clara Schumann. Yeah, this is Liebst du Schönheit, and of course that text was used, of course, by the likes of Mahler as well throughout the 19th century. A very, very popular text to use. But it's an exquisite song, and it is exemplary as well of what a master craftswoman Clara Schumann actually was.
And let's listen to a recording with Barbara Bonney, accompanied by Vladimir Ashkenazy. Indeed, there from Clara Schumann, Liebst du Schönheit, recording there featuring Barbara Bonney and Vladimir Ashkenazy, but it is Nicola Ring and Fiacre Garvey who will be performing this as part of Liberation, the music of Daniel O'Connell. Gavin Ring curating the concert for the Daniel O'Connell Summer School this weekend. I have to finish up with a little bit of Verdi, because obviously if you think of music and politics and particularly nationalism at that period in time, you have to think of Verdi, and Daniel O'Connell's connection with Italy is another reason to go there.
Absolutely. I mean, Verdi is considered one of the founding fathers of modern Italy, and in the same way as that we would view O'Connell in this country as one of our own founding fathers. But absolutely. So again, I mean, Verdi, profoundly political, profoundly influential as far as the socio-political and cultural trajectory of his country was concerned. So again, yet another link in that era. Now, Verdi, of course, comes in terms of O'Connell's life, comes quite late.
Yes.
But nonetheless, it's part of that fibre. It's part of that rich texture of change. Yeah, well, of freedom, as it were.
Yeah. If you even think of the fact that Verdi's name was used as an acronym for Vittorio Emanuele Re d'Italia, Viva Verdi.
Exactly.
They were actually saying, long live the King, Vittorio Emanuele, the King of Italy. That's what was being said by using his name in that fashion. But the Daniel O'Connell connection with Italy is well worth telling as well.
Well, absolutely. Of course, you know, I mean, O'Connell was devoutly Catholic. And unfortunately, towards the end of his life, he was suffering from a softening of the brain, and that's what eventually he died from. And his dying wish, of course, was that his heart would be taken and buried in Rome, and that his body would be brought to Ireland. And that's what transpired.
And maybe you'd finish up then, Gavin, by setting up for us a recording we have of yourself singing from Verdi's La Traviata, O mio remorso, the Cabaletta.
That's right. Okay, the infamous Cabaletta, Sean, which you have the option, of course, on the night of doing a repeat of. Most tenors shy away from it, including my good self. But no, this is one of the most dramatic moments of La Traviata, of course, and Alfredo is faced with the reality that Violetta has been selling off all her possessions to fund their opulent lifestyle, and he vows to return to Paris and to right all these wrongs. So this is the number, as they say.
Yeah, and this is your good self singing at Gavin Ring with the RTE National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Prontius O'Din. Thanks for speaking with us this evening, Gavin.
Thanks a million, Sean. You're a star.
So infamia, io avvisi in tal errore, ma il colpe solo frange, il ver mi pannerò.
Oh, and I guess that final high note is just one of the reasons that many tenors refuse the option of the repeat of the Cabaletta from Verdi's La Traviata. There you heard Gavin Ring with the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra conducted by Prunches O'Din. And Gavin will be performing that along with the other pieces he was telling us about this Saturday, October the 23rd at the Skellig 618 Distillery in Carters Eveen, County Kerry, home of the great liberator Daniel O'Connell. Gavin will be there with pianist Fiacre Gavry, his wife Nicola Ring, that's Gavin's wife, and other musicians as well, performing the music of Beethoven, John Field, Donizetti, Clara Schumann and others. The gala concert has been put together in conjunction with the Daniel O'Connell Summer School. Full details of everything else happening at the festival and indeed Gavin Ring's concert on danielo'connellsummerschool.com. Singer-songwriter Lux Alma has released a new track in collaboration with Miss Kate, also known as the actor Kate Stanley Brennan. The two toured together as part of Riot a few years ago. Here's a piece called In the Place. In the Place there from Lux Alma and Miss Kate. It's available on Spotify, iTunes, all digital platforms, and the accompanying virtual reality video will be released on October 27th. You can find out more on luxalmamusic.com and misskateofficial.com. Just a few short weeks have passed since our special preview of this year's Dublin Theatre Festival featuring Louise Lowe talking about The Book of Names, co-production between her company Anu and Landmark Productions. Philip McMahon introduced us to Once Before I Go, and there was much more besides. But as they say, the results are now in. And after 2 weeks of full-on theatre, critics Helen Meaney and Peter Crawley are with me in studio this evening to look back at five shows that they have seen. The festival may just have ended, but some plays are running on either in reality or in an online capacity. And of course, let's hope that there will be tours or future stagings of other shows as well. We'll start with The Book of Names. First time Anu has joined with Landmark Productions to create a site-specific work at the Dublin Docks. Famous Anu for their site-specific work, Mining Ireland's Social History. What aspect of our history are they mining in this particular piece, Helen?
Thanks, Sean. They are looking at the end of the final months of the War of Independence, and it's set down in the former pump house in Dublin Docks. It's site specific, and we're looking at a company of the IRA called Q Company that was really involved in most of the ammunition. Import or smuggling into Dublin Port, therefore a really important part of the story of the War of Independence. And we're brought into this group of men and kind of caught up in their conflicts with each other and also with the violence of the ambushes, the extraordinary just shooting in point blank of the black and tans. So it's depicting a lot of violence and confusion.
And one of the things that Anu Productions do very well is you immediately, almost within 3 seconds of entering any of their theatre spaces, Peter, you are complicit in whatever is happening. And I think this show does that as well. How does it pull you in and how do you become part of the action, if you like?
Slowly at first and then all of a sudden. So I think the thing that Anu have been doing for more than a decade now and are sort of, you know, world leaders at is the creation of immersive productions, site-specific productions, site-responsive productions. And there is a sort of mild difference. Here you can say they arguably do both. The Pump House in Dublin Docklands was a historical place. It was a hiding space for members of Q Company. It's responsive in the Pump House has been designed in this fastidious beautifully hermetic way, so that once you kind of cross the threshold, you do enter into this very vivid, very persuasive past. And if, like me, you try to keep your critical faculties with you and sort of understand and decode and sort of make mental notes, the rug is pulled out from under you. You're immediately plunged into the action. And to take historical subjects and to treat them as though they are living entities, to see kind of historical figures, not even as your contemporaries, but actually as people who are younger than you, boys, you know, in the mess of the moment, right? So this is before the history is written, before the sides have even been taken, and before the actions have been committed to. Everything is just, it's not black and white, it's just this murk of greys. And you might find yourself pulled into a room with the custodian of the Book of Names, essentially like this document for a hit squad, who takes his job very seriously about identifying the right kind of RIC targets, and then asks you to mark the next hit in a book. And do you do that? You know, to be put on the spot.
The stakes are vivid and high
in living.
This is the thing that Anu do all the time. They put you in this situation where you're saying, oh, well, I wouldn't have made that choice. And then suddenly they hand you a choice and say, okay, you go ahead and make the choice now. It's very difficult and really thought-provoking theatre, Helen.
It is. It's confrontational and can be quite raw, can be emotional. And that you, as a viewer, have to react and you have to respond in that moment. And it's completely experiential, and it's also very much your own response. And so that's what really makes it distinctive.
And we should also point out it's a very small audience, an audience of eight, which is then split into two groups of four. So you're really isolated in your choice making as well. This is running on, I think, as well, a little bit. Or it's certainly available online afterwards,
so
isn't it?
So this has both been extended very laudably and justifiably, I think, until the 13th of November. I could not tell you about ticket availability at the moment.
Yeah, but that's extended.
It is also available online and on demand.
I actually watched it again online just to see all the bits I missed.
Obviously not as immersive experience as being there.
Actually,
but still,
it was so well filmed that you were, and you had the benefit of close-ups as well. So highly recommend that.
Okay, well, that's definitely worth checking out. Yeah, the Book of Names and Anu, they're always a joy and provocative to watch and see. Let's move on then to Once Before I Go. This is Philly McMahon's play at the Gate Theatre, directed by Selena Cartman, the cast including Sean Campion, Aisling O'Sullivan and Matthew Malone. What's the basic setup here, Peter?
So this is Philip McMahon's new play for The Gate. It's a story of three central characters and told in reverse, as though plunging back in time. And it serves as a kind of a personal chronicle of the gay rights movement in Ireland and also the AIDS epidemic. We meet three characters, or actually we meet two characters, Dahi and Lynn, who are long estranged friends, once very close. Dahi was the lover to Lynn's brother, Bernard. He is a figure we do not meet in the first act, but he is so luminescent that when his ashes are produced on stage and thrown in fistfuls, they form plumes of glitter. And it's a really interesting moment because I think it reveals a lot about what Philip Mann and director Selena Cartmel's relationship is through this production, which is kind of always finding the fault lines between reality and fantasy. And to do so with a political reason, as you move back in time from 2019 to 1987, you meet them younger in the sort of the heat of what I think I can call LGB movement, because it was yet to gain a few initials in that time.
Yeah.
And they talk about their politics, and they talk about the meaning of their politics. This is when we meet Bernard, who's played in a really luminescent performance by Matthew Malone, resplendent in the shock of a pink hair dye, which I can only assume was available in the 80s. It's hard to tell from the VHS memories I have of it. But he talks about himself as a kind of like a performer of politics. He says kind of it doesn't get more political than mincing down Grafton Street wearing fishnets.
And we got to remember 1987 was a very different place than the Ireland of 2021. So we're looking at 2019 and 1987. I'll hold off on the third part just for the time being, Helen, because I want to talk about there's a lot of music, there's a lot of dance in this, there's a lot of cabaret style in this. Was there enough of it to carry? Because there's a lot of politics and a lot of kind of context to be given as well.
There's a lot of history, and it's a huge, huge subject, and it's a really important subject to talk about, particularly the diaspora, all of those people, all those gay men and lesbians who left Ireland. So that's very much the focus of this. And then to talk about the gay rights movement and all of the internal debates at the time, including sort of the lesbian in the character of Lynn as but a, I think as a young woman.
But I think you felt she was that maybe her character suffered slightly. You didn't get enough of her backstory.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the challenge of this play was to be try and be representative of a whole of lots of different experiences. And but the focus was definitely on Doughy and Bernard. And I do think Lynn's character was underwritten. But in addition to that, they have a lot of exposition and explanation of the politics and the social and cultural context in that second act.
But the real emotional heart of the play is the third act, when we get to meet Bernard and Doughy in Paris, isn't it? They're in Paris at this stage in 1991.
Yes.
That's the bit that's going to, not tug at the heartstrings, punch you in the stomach and leave you in bits, really.
I think yank very firmly at the heartstrings, that also kind of, you know, make particular demands of how you interpret it. It's they live an impossibly glittering life in Paris to begin with. And there's something kind of, there's something like fabulously artificial about how that's treated just scenographically in Francis O'Connor's set. Like it seems a little unreal, a little too shimmering, the fridge so full of champagne. I think at this point, kind of like that sense of like performance politics or rather kind of yourself as a performance of politics becomes kind of all the more striking. One note I have about this in particular is that while it's queer in content, addressing this kind of gay movement history, it's not queer in form. It's actually quite a traditional, kind of conventional piece. And I think that's one of the reasons it may feel overloaded a little bit, like it's going to encapsulate too much of that material in individuals.
I think, Helen, perhaps you thought there was a great musical in here bursting to get out.
Well, there could be, but and also more of a focus on Bernard and on Doughy, you know, so that I think the whole thing needs to be reshaped a little to get us
standout
more
deeply.
Well, it has to be the character of Bernard.
Matthew Malone.
He just owned the stage in drag in a really shimmering dress and heels, and a great mover as well. Great choreography, and so it does come alive in those musical and dance moments.
Of course, Philip McMahon, the writer here associated with This Is Pop Baby, and it's to a This Is Pop Baby production that we go next. Helen, give us a sense of what's happening in Conversations After Sex. This is, I don't quite know how to describe it in terms of how both connected and disconnected you are from the people on stage and how connected and disconnected they are. That, give me that setup.
Yes, so it is really a play about the possibility of making connections between strangers, really, who happen to be meeting for sex. So the central character is they're all unnamed, by the way. So the central character is played by Kate Stanley Brennan,
who incidentally we were hearing in another guy's earlier on with Lux Helman.
And she's meeting up with men for sex, as the title tells us. And it's not a dating, app or anything. It is actually to have sex and with strangers. And what we see over the course of a year is that she meets a number of men, but she meets three of them a couple of times.
Right.
So in other words, they do start to get to know each other.
How many people are we dealing with on stage here, Peter?
So in total, we have three bodies on stage. Yeah. So this is performed by three performers. That's Kate Stanley Brennan, Fiona
Lawrence. She's the central woman.
She is the central and kind of like continuous central character. And Fiona Lawrence, who plays every male who she encounters. This is never stated overtly, but her character seems to have a particular thing for guys with regional accents, which makes it possible for Fiona Lawrence to play a parade of different characters and have them very clearly delineated.
All right.
When she's with that Belfast brute, you know when she's with that suffering North England drug-addled fellow, you know when she's with the grieving North Dubliner, and you know when she's with the adorable musical South Dublin poppet. It's technically kind of a very, very smart thing to do, but it also allows you to appreciate Fiona Lawrence's fantastic performance because he can be so many different people.
Yeah.
And then for exactly the same reason, and this is a testament, I think, to Mark O'Halloran's writing, Kate Stanley Brennan's performance for also being so many different people in one person. And the understanding is that we are different people with different people.
Yeah.
And it's as a character portrait, I think it's really quite fascinating because you get her in fractures. You get her in contradictory moods. You know, sometimes she's needy, sometimes she's aloof, sometimes she's interested, sometimes she's bored, sometimes she's drunk, and sometimes she's high. And it's a portrait of a very shattered person at a shattered time trying to sort of recompose themselves.
it sounds like, another very thought-provoking piece, Helen. Did it work for you?
Yes, I'm also really focused. It's the direction by Tom Creed is so precise. His attention to the minutiae of gesture and facial expression, vocal expression, and then the whole composition of the visuals by Sarah Bacon and Sarah Jane Shields, and this kind of these diagonal lights showing in silhouette, kind of just a very stripped back urban scene, and then nothing in the play and in the writing is extraneous.
It is paired back
to the bone.
Did we mention the third?
Niamh McCann plays the sister of the Kate Stanley Brennan character, and she's unhappy in a completely different way in a marriage. And so that's where we get another side of what happened to Kate Stanley Brennan's character. So there's quite a lot going on.
You've certainly had three good evenings at the theatre so far, and an extra evening at home since you watched a new. At home as well. Let's move on then to the Peacock. And in fact, the Abbey currently welcomes its new artistic director, Katrina McLaughlin, directed Alwyn Ferrer and Marina Carr's Eye Girl. But we're looking at the debut solo play, which was Downstairs, as they say, in the Peacock, Purple Snowflakes and Tittywanks. Again, the title maybe gives us a bit of a sense of what's going on here. Written and performed by Sarah Hanley. What's she writing, or what's she performing for us here, Peter?
So she's performing her debut play, a coming-of-age story, which is told with great sexual frankness and huge lashings of good humour about a young Irish woman who's leaving her convent school in Wicklow, eventually finding herself in musical theatre schools of London, and contending throughout this journey with ideas of sexuality, body politics, and then fundamentally her own sense of agency. One of the most remarkable things about it is actually the tone. We've dealt with, you know, art and theatre about sexual awakening and religious repression before, but it's rare to see sort of examples like this when it's done with a kind of a comic weightlessness that maybe kind of puts you more in mind of something like Derry Girls than necessarily Philadelphia, Here I Come.
So this says a lot about Sarah Hanley. This is a debut... big performance, I suppose, for her, but it's certainly a debut piece of writing. Is she one to watch on the basis of this?
Oh, she is, yes, yeah. I mean, she's under commission by the Royal Court, and you know, the play was published by Faber, so that's quite an honour for a young playwright. I think what is really interesting about this is a portrayal of the pressures on young women, particularly around the whole question of consent. So we seem to have gone forward in so many ways about her openness about her own sexual drives and so on. But in other ways, we're going backwards in terms of the relationships with the boys, the pressure she's under to have quite degrading and exploitative sex, and then how that's turned inwards into a very serious eating disorder. Yeah. Plus, her friend is you know, self-harming. All these problems are there underneath the levity of the tone.
So there's a kind of a cracked nature in some ways to how you're describing the play to me. Does the production match that cracked quality?
Yes, I mean, I think that the production is really polished, and I felt that it smoothed over some of the real seriousness and the problems that this woman is going through. And I think I think it would have worked in a more stripped back, harder edged, maybe like a stand up fringe kind of show where we got the real sense of the eating disorder in a more bleak way. I thought the tone was a little too chirpy.
I wonder if it's less contradiction and more symptom. I think it's for whatever reason, the levity is actually part of the response.
Sure. It's defensive.
It's absolutely there. Yeah. It's the fact that they kind of exist in this kind of, you know, strange friction all throughout. I think that is the expression. I'm kind of considering more and more kind of why this tone for this material.
Okay, well, let's move on then. Finally, brief word on The First Bad Man. Gavin Quinn of Pan Pan Theatre was in telling us about this. Demanding a lot from his audience was Gavin Quinn of Pan Pan with this one. A book club is essentially what you had to be part of, Peter.
You're entreated to join Pan Pan's book club. They send you a copy of the book, which is Miranda July's debut novel, The First Bad Man, ahead of the performance. And you were encouraged to read it or as much of it as possible before attending one of, and here I have to take Gavin Quinn on face value, one of five different iterations of this evening. So give me, each performance is quite different.
Give me in 15 seconds the essence of what you saw, because I think Helen saw a different night.
Yes, we have had very different experiences, I believe. So you appear into the church hall to form a circle with your other audience members and the cast, and also Pan Pan themselves, who line the space wearing black sweaters emblazoned with the logo Pan Pandemic, which already feels like somewhere between kind of absurd and menacing at the same time.
They have face masks with the same thing on them.
And the characters talk about the book. I mean, like, the remarkable thing is they do talk about the book, and then they come to play the characters in the book. And
so
the,
give me, who played what on the night you saw it?
So they, Judith Roddy played a person engaged with the book who then came to role play or cosplay, as she put it, Cheryl, who is the lead character in Miranda Julie's novel.
What did you see, Helen?
I saw Cheryl and all the other characters played by the book club members. And the funny thing, the humour is derives from the fact that the book club members are very similar to the characters in the novel. And so they essentially start playing themselves. And the really ridiculous thing is this book club meets for 2 years, once a week, discussing this same novel.
So it's going to
continue. Just a bit obsessive.
Which is information that you knew, but not our performance.
I won't have you finish the book because we're too embarrassed to admit it in front of the other book club members, I'm sure. Highlight of the festival for you, Helen?
Oh, very hard, but I think I'm going to go with Conversations After Sex.
Conversations After Sex, that was the Kate Sandy Brennan, Mark O'Halloran piece.
Tom Creed's direction.
And what was the highlight for you, Peter?
I also find it hard to say, for very different reasons, they all stick with me. But the Anu performance, I was surprised by how involved and moved I was by it, then surprised that I was surprised by that. This is something that Anu have been doing to me and many people steadily for more than a decade.
All right, and of course, we're back now, aren't we? And it was an odd theatre festival in many ways, because we were all distanced and stuff like that, but it was great to be back.
A celebratory one. We're learning how to be with each other again.
Absolutely. Dublin Theatre Festival ended at the weekend. The Book of Names has extra dates, 25th of October to the 13th of November. Once Before I Go is at the Gate Theatre until the 30th of October. Further details on anuproductions.ie, gatetheatre.ie. Conversations After Sex, available on demand until the 23rd of October, we're told. Details at dublintheatrefestival.ie. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. It is. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.